From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Paul Schrader wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ. On today's Fresh Air, the filmmaker tells us that he was brought up in a strict Calvinist home and was forbidden to set foot in a movie theater when he was growing up. Also today, we travel to the Great Plains with writer Ian Fraser, and he explains why he calls the vast center of our country a time park. Music critic Milo Miles introduces us to Algerian rhyme music, and television critic David Bianculli looks at Monday nights on CBS. It's three straight hours of sitcoms, including the new shows Major Dad and the famous Teddy Z. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The youth who held 11 students hostage at a McKee, Kentucky high school today has released the last of his hostages and surrendered to police. The teenager gave up shortly after allowing the last two hostages to go free. The heavily armed youth took over a classroom this morning, holding 11 hostages. His lone demand had been to speak with his father, who lives in Florida. President Bush, amid reports that he has ordered stepped-up security for his family, said today he has no hard intelligence about threats to himself or his relatives from South American drug lords. Earlier, Bush's spokesman, Marlon Fitzwater, declined comment on what type Secret Service protection has been afforded the five grown Bush children. Earlier today, the president urged Americans to begin a reforestation program by planting trees in their backyards. He was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to participate in a state centennial celebration. More from John Gordon of South Dakota Public Radio.
Bush urged South Dakotans to join in what he called the new greening of America, saying we need to replenish the land. Bush called trees the oldest, cheapest, and most efficient air purifiers on Earth.
It is planting time now for your great state, for South Dakota, and for America, and for all of spaceship Earth. The choices that we make today can either nurture and protect our children or bequeath them only another generation of thickets and foul air.
The president planted a centennial tree in Sioux Falls and is to do the same today in Helena, Montana, and tomorrow in Spokane, Washington. For National Public Radio, this is John Gordon in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
The Ford Motor Company has agreed to recall 500,000 vehicles built during 1985 and 1986, which failed to meet federal emission standards. Don Gagne of Michigan Public Radio reports.
The vehicles in question are the 1985 Ford Escort and Mercury Lynx, as well as the 1986 Escort, Lynx, and Ford EXP models. All are equipped with 1.9-liter engines. The Environmental Protection Agency says tests revealed excessive hydrocarbon and carbon monoxide emissions. Repairs will be conducted by Ford dealers and will include the installation of a more durable crankcase and better exhaust ventilation. The car's pollution control system, which helps the catalytic converter handle hydrocarbons and carbon monoxide, will also be changed. Ford says it will notify owners of the recall. There will be no charge for the repairs, regardless of the vehicle's mileage. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Hurricane Hugo's 125-mile-an-hour wind swept across Puerto Rico today. After ripping across other islands in the eastern Caribbean, at least 14 people are dead, thousands are homeless. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 13 points today to close at 2687.5. Declines led advances by about 80 issues. This is NPR News. Government officials from 15 countries have ended their meeting in Paris after discussing ways to fight the international drug trade. As Roger Morier reports, the officials are concentrating on ways to trace billions of dollars in profits in the drug trade.
The one-day meeting was shrouded in secrecy. No journalists were allowed near the meeting place. Nothing was said about the meeting afterwards. 15 countries showed up, including Switzerland and Luxembourg, two countries whose rules on banking secrecy are said to make life easier for drug lords as they try to hide their profits. The discussions today centered on international cooperation and on exchanging information on the laundering of money. The United Nations estimates that the worldwide drug trade is worth $300 billion a year. And every day, a part of that money is made legitimate through deposits and withdrawals and investments in banks around the world. Government officials say that drug money laundering is so sophisticated that some governments don't even know when their laws are being broken. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Morier in Paris.
Burroughs Welcome Company today announced a 20% reduction in the price of AZT, the only drug approved in the United States for fighting AIDS. The reduction, effective immediately, reduces the price to the wholesale distributor from $1.50 to $1.20 per capsule. Researchers using the first approved transfer of a foreign gene into humans said today that altered cancer-fighting cells have shrunk tumors in one patient that cells from a single injection continue to work for at least 19 days. National Cancer Institute researcher Steven Rosenberg said that five patients, all terminally ill with cancer, called malignant melanoma, have been treated with gene-modified cells, but he could report only on one patient. She is a 26-year-old woman. Rosenberg reported last year that his technique resulted in a 50% reduction in at least 60% of the patients he treated. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sin and redemption are recurring themes in the work of filmmaker Paul Schrader. So it was a logical choice when director Martin Scorsese asked Schrader to write the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ. Scorsese had already directed Schrader screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. The Last Temptation of Christ is now out on home video. When it was released in theaters last year, it aroused angry protests by Christian fundamentalists who objected to scenes that portrayed Christ as having human desires and weaknesses. The protesters might have been surprised to learn that Schrader was brought up in a very religious Calvinist home. In fact, as a young man, he had planned to become a minister. Movies were banned by his church, and it wasn't until he was a teenager that he went to a movie theater. Schrader fell in love with movies, and instead of entering the ministry, he became a film critic, then a screenwriter and director. He wrote and directed the films blue-collar, hardcore American gigolo Mishima and Light of Day, and he directed Patty Hearst. In The Last Temptation of Christ, much of the dialogue sounds more like Brooklynese than biblical English. I asked Schrader why.
Well, Kazantzakis wrote the original script in a dialect so that he could be slangy.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, he felt the same limitations that anyone would feel in dealing with the scriptures, because people remember this King James English, and you can't make a film in Aramaic. So that you don't want to make it in King James English, because that's just certainly incorrect. And you don't want to make it in Aramaic, because no one will understand it. So you have to find some way to make it sound fresh. And that means you just have to bite the bullet and use vernacular.
Well, instead of live by the sword, you die by the sword, it's, mm-hmm. you wrote, you live by this, you die by this.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of the dialogue was changed by,
I see, uh-huh.
by Scorsese. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, basically because it isn't in Aramaic, but it is in street English, it will always sound wrong. And in the end, when he's directing the movie, he's more comfortable with his version of how it sounds wrong than someone else's version of how it sounds wrong. So it keeps getting changed.
What was your version of how that sounded wrong?
My version was a little more poetic. It was a little, you know, a little more florid than his version.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're writing on the page, it's always a different thing, and you tend to write speeches, you know, and when you're directing, you tend to direct conversations. So part of that is the process in all films, but I have a memory that my script was a little more purple than the movie.
Was the screenplay toned down from the original version? I believe you wrote about two drafts, and then there were several drafts after that. Was the screenplay consciously toned down because of the controversy?
Not much. Certainly not because of the controversy. In the original novel, Paul stones Mary Magdalene to death. And that was, you know, Marty just said to me, he said, with everything else I'm doing, I just can't have St. Paul stone a pregnant woman to death. So you know, that was like a toning down decision. And some of the sexual language may have been pulled back a little, but not any more than the sort of changes that are made on any of our collaborations.
Did you expect this degree of controversy when you started working on the film?
Not when I started writing it, because I come from a conservative religious background that was rather intellectual, so I was used to kind of intense theological argument. But then in 83, when the evangelicals blocked the film from being made at Paramount, we knew it was coming.
Were you ever the slightest bit concerned yourself that it might be a sin to write this way about Jesus?
No, I mean, there's an element of anti-intellectualism in all of this. And just because you need the faith of a child to enter into the kingdom of heaven doesn't mean you have to have the mind of a child. And it is possible to be an intelligent, questioning person and still have faith. And if I remember correctly, the Protestant Reformation was about exactly this point. And there is nothing wrong with this kind of theological argument. And certainly this argument, the dual nature of Christ, is the most central to Christianity itself.
Filmmaker Paul Schrader is my guest. Now, there used to be a ban in your church against seeing movies. Does that ban still exist?
No. I think that they have made that a matter of individual conscience now. It banned what they called worldly amusements, which included things like card playing and smoking and drinking and dancing and theater attendance. And this came out of Prohibition days. The ban was actually instituted in 1928. And, I once, as a child, rather impassionately queried my mother about this. I think I wanted to see some Disney film. And she said to me, "It doesn't matter. The quality of the film doesn't matter. It's the industry that is evil." And so I think that was the position.
Did you have a sense of what you were missing?
No, and I'm actually very happy about having missed all those.
No, really? Come on.
Well, yeah, because really? Because you are imprinted as an artist or as a person by, how you come to a specific field. And I came to films as a college student, and the first films I really saw or paid serious attention to were the films by Bergman or Buñuel, Antonioni, Bresson. And that was my original imprinting in films. And my peers and coevals, were imprinted with Westerns and Disney films. And when they say, "I want to make the movies that I loved when I was a child," they think about those films. And when I say that, I don't think about those films. I think about the kind of childhood background and about the films I first came to love. I came to films as an adult and then later learned to love them as a child. So it has given me a unique perspective and a unique place in this business. And I've never really worried about anyone doing what I'm doing because no one has my perspective.
What's the first film you saw and what effect did it have on you?
Well, actually, the first film was a Disney film. It was Absent-Minded Professor. And I snuck...
Is that the one with Jerry Lewis, or is that the Nutty Professor?
That's the Nutty Professor. This is the one with Fred McMurray.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the one about Flubber.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, I snuck into the balcony, and I sat there watching this, and I was wondering what all this fuss was about. And then about a year later, a friend of mine took me to see Wild in the Country with Elvis Presley and Tuesday Weld. And I sat there, and I realized, aha, this is why they don't want me to go. Here's the problem.
And what effect did that have on you, seeing that?
Well, I had developed a mad crush on Tuesday Weld.
And did that make you feel bad?
No, it made me want to see more movies.
Yeah, so what made you so passionate about movies?
Well, it was a very luxurious forbidden fruit. I mean, not only could you be a rebel and do something that upset your elders, but you could also wear the mantle of respectability while you were doing it. It was like having your cake and eating it. It was a rare opportunity, to be a rebel without having to do things like break into cars.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work and also about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. Paul Schrader is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ. His other film credits include the screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, which were both directed by Martin Scorsese. And Schrader also wrote and directed Hardcore, Blue Collar, American Gigolo, and Light of Day. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Screenwriter and director Paul Schrader is my guest. You had intended, I think, to be a minister, and then you became a film critic and then a screenwriter and director. Why had you wanted to be a minister?
Well, it was just sort of part and parcel of the background. You know, those were the most respected figures, and I've always had this sort of proselytizing urge, you know, to go out and communicate and convert. And so that was rather natural.
Do you feel like you channeled that urge into movies?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious.
One of your movies, Hardcore, is about a father from a background similar to yours, a Calvinist in Grand Rapids. And this father's daughter runs away to the city where she starts working in pornographic movies. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if your parents felt like the father in this movie when you left home and started just working in regular movies, if the movies were so extreme to them in the first place, that it might have been hardcore.
You know, I suspect they may well have. You know, they've had to make some hard compromises over the years. And my mother's dead, but my father has had to, you know, in order to keep his family relationship.
Did they ever break the ban to see any of your movies?
I believe so, but it's not. Not a subject that comes up.
You've been collaborating with Martin Scorsese on and off since the mid-70s. The first time you collaborated was on the film Taxi Driver. You had written the screenplay, and you asked, I think, that he direct the movie. And I think you wanted him to direct it after seeing his film Mean Streets.
Right.
What was it about Mean Streets that you knew was the right sensibility for the film you were making, Taxi Driver?
Oh, it's just a passion, you know. And also the perversity, you know. Someone who is willing to grab the thing, put it between his teeth, bite hard and run, you know. I don't want to use words we can't use on language, but someone who has the guts to do it.
Now, in Taxi Driver, your screenplay is about a lonely, alienated, psychopathic taxi driver. You've described the taxi as the perfect metaphor for loneliness, a man driving around the city in a steel coffin. And his alienation erupts into a bloody killing spree at the end of the movie, which he thinks of in heroic terms. He thinks he's helping to clean the city of the pimps and the filth. I want to play from go ahead.
What's interesting about that is in the film, he fixates on two women, one of whom he can have and one of whom he can't. And, of course, he wants the one he can't and doesn't want the one he can. And out of this dilemma, he decides to kill the father figure of the good girl, who is a politician. And when he cannot do that, he fails, he kills the father figure of the bad girl, who's the prostitute. And what's interesting, in his mind, there's really not much difference. They're both, you know, there's these competing father figures. It's just that in society's mind, of course, he becomes a hero because one of them was a pimp and not a politician.
Sounds a little Freudian. Were you in Freudian analysis at the time?
No, subsequently.
Okay. Well, you wrote the journal, the diary, for Travis Bickle, the taxi driver, which De Niro just gives a brilliant reading of in the movie. I want to play some of that, and this is from the record, so it's excerpts edited together from the film.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Robert De Niro over a score by Bernard Herrmann with the screenplay by my guest Paul Schrader from Taxi Driver.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks.
I'm working long hours now, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in $350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. All the animals come out at night. Buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets. I go all over. I take people to the Bronx, Brooklyn. I take them to Harlem. I don't care. Don't make no difference to me. It does to some. Some won't even take spooks. Don't make no difference to me. Each night when I return the cab to the garage, I have to clean the back seat. Some nights I clean off the blood. 12 hours of work and I still can't sleep. Damn. Days go on and on. They don't end. All my life needed was a sense of someplace to go. I don't believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention. I believe that someone should become a person like other people.
The tone of writing in that seems so perfect for the character.
I love that line. I do not believe that one should devote his life in more self-attention, which, of course, is what this character does.
Oh, precisely.
Every moment of the day.
And the next line is just the most perfect line about alienation I think I've ever heard. I believe that somebody should become a person like other people. It's just the perfect expression of alienation. How did you know, not being a psychopath yourself, how did you know the tone of voice to get for this? It just seems just right.
Well, I wrote that script in 10 days, in two drafts. It jumped out of my head like an animal. And so it was a really a cri de coeur. It was a cry from my heart. I've fallen into a difficult period in Los Angeles where I was living in my car and just sort of driving around. And having a lot of trouble sleeping. And finally I got a pain in my stomach, which turned out to be an ulcer. And I went in the hospital. And then while I was talking to a nurse in emergency, I realized I hadn't spoken to anyone in several weeks. And when I was in the hospital, I realized that that's what I was. I was like a taxi driver. I was like this person who was floating around in this car. And I got out of the hospital, and I wrote that script, like I said, in 10 days.
Let's get back to the tone that you actually wrote it in. There's something almost Old Testament about the tone. Someday a real rain will come along and wash all the scum off the streets. But that's that apocalyptic sense.
Yeah, I really, you know, that was my first real script. I'd done one thing before. And I didn't know how you were supposed to write scripts yet.
Did it scare you that you were able to so authentically and so intuitively capture a psychopathic voice?
Well, you know, it scared me that I was at that place at that time. I mean, the person who wrote that script is long gone, and I don't even know if I would recognize him if I saw him.
What was your reaction when Hinckley said that he was... He had seen Taxi Driver, and he wanted to impress Jodie Foster by attempting to assassinate the president.
Sort of, I was in New Orleans at the time, scouting locations, and they came over the radio that this kid had tried to kill Reagan. And he was from Colorado, sort of a white bread kid. And I said to the person sitting next to me, I said, it's one of those Taxi Driver kids. And I got back to the hotel, and the FBI was waiting for me. And in fact, it was one of those Taxi Driver kids. You know, the film didn't create them. They exist before the film and after the film, and they attach themselves to many things. More. You know, it's just actually sort of rare that they attach themselves to a good film. More likely, they attach themselves to things like advertising.
Mm-hmm. You know, you are always warned about the danger of films. Did any of that come back to you after this?
No.
Not relevant.
I think art really works, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it is possible through artifice to, vicariously purge yourself of these dangerous feelings.
You said that you are no longer the same person who wrote Taxi Driver, that you don't really have those feelings anymore. At that time, I think you were really motivated by certain demons, by alienation, by loneliness. You're now married, you're a father, and I figure loneliness wouldn't have the same pull on you that it did then. Are there different things that motivate you now in your writing, or even different demons that drive you?
Yeah, certainly. And you miss those old demons, you know, boy, because those are powerful engines, and they really drive you hard. It was actually easier to write then because you had no choice. You were just trying to, you were running to keep the demons from swallowing you up. So today it's a little more difficult. You have to use your imaginative powers and your creative skills to a greater degree.
What kind of compromise do you feel that you have been or have had to make in your career between writing screenplays that fit your vision, that communicate the ideas that you're interested in, and you really do communicate ideas in your screenplays, and making something that's actually saleable?
Well, I mean, I want to communicate. You know, the movie business is the business of mass communication. If you're not interested in mass communication, you shouldn't be in this business. So, you know, whatever your personal visions are, you have to put them in the seat alongside the idea of mass communication. So it's just not possible to say, I don't care who sees this movie. I try to think of things in commercial terms. You know, how will people want to see and hear this? And so I don't avoid that. However, it is not possible to escape the idiosyncrasies of your own psychology. I remember when I did Cat People years ago, and I said to myself, now I'm going to do a film that is not personal. I'm going to do a genre movie, a horror movie, a special effects film. It's not going to be about me at all. Well, I look back now at that film, I think it's more personal than any of the others.
In what ways?
I just feel that the character of the zookeeper is really me. And when I set out to make the film, I didn't think that at all. So you can't really escape yourself.
Is that considered a liability in parts of Hollywood, that you would put yourself into it and that you would end up putting certain ideas into a screenplay, even unintentionally?
Well, it is a liability. And the fact of the matter is that I do exist sort of on the cusp of the industry. But that's fine with me, you know, as long as I can keep working and doing the films I want. And the industry understands very well that last year's cusp can very easily become this year's center.
Several of your films, like Patty and Hardcore, are in their way about leaving the family and about breaking away, either voluntarily or involuntarily, from what your life has been. When you left your home and when you broke away from the church, was that a wrenching experience for you?
No. I mean, it was more like the way a bullet must feel when it's finally discharged from a gun.
You want to explain that?
Well, I've been waiting a long time to get out of there, and I came out with a bang, you know, and I took off and didn't look back.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us. Paul Schrader's latest films, The Last Temptation of Christ and Patty Hearst, are now out on home video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, investigative reporter Thomas Moore challenges current medical advice about reducing the risk of heart attack through a low cholesterol diet. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ian Frazier is known for his humor pieces in The New Yorker, but now Frazier's written a travel book about America's Great Plains. Coming up, Ian Frazier tells us what he found during his 25,000-mile journey through the heart of America. Also, music critic Milo Miles returns with another example of what they're listening to and dancing to in other countries. This time, the country's Algeria, and the music is Pop Rye. And television critic David Bianculli reviews three new sitcoms on CBS Monday nights: Major Dad, The Famous Teddy Z, and The People Next Door. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After a day-long standoff, an armed teenager in McKee, Kentucky, has released all of his hostages and surrendered to police. Several shots were fired, but no one was injured after the teenager took 11 classmates hostage at the Jackson County High School. The youth, whose only request was to speak to his father, told his hostages he did not want to hurt anyone. McKee is a town about 50 miles southeast of Lexington. It's not clear why the youth took over the classroom. Officials described him as a newcomer to the school who had been living with his grandparents, but some students say that they have known him for years. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney said today that the U.S. military will step up its part in the war on drugs. NPR's Neil Conan has more on the story.
The primary role will continue to be interdiction, but Secretary Cheney also said that training, intelligence, and operational support can help outside U.S. borders. And the U.S. troops can do more in this country, too, though he was careful to say that they would not usurp police powers. He also drew a clear line restricting U.S. forces from a combat role, but he anticipated that a few hundred servicemen and women will become involved in Latin America and that more teams of U.S. advisors will be sent to Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. The secretary did not offer details. Specific plans are due from military commanders on October 15th, nor how much they'll cost, nor where that money will come from. He did reject one proposal that U.S. forces be authorized to shoot down private planes that refuse warnings to land. This is Neil Conan reporting.
The Borough Welcome Company today announced a 20% cut in the price of the anti-AIDS drug AZT. But as Adam Hochberg reports, company officials insist the price drop is not related to pressure that the company has been receiving from AIDS activists.
AIDS activists have staged a number of protests against Burroughs Welcome, alleging the company's profit on AZT is too high. But company spokesman Thack Brown says those protests did not prompt the price reduction. Rather, he says the company is able to lower the price of AZT because new uses have been found for it.
More patients will be using the drug, which broadens the market base and reduces some of the financial risk in terms of how much we've got hanging out there in case something happens to the drug or there's competition in the marketplace or whatever.
Recent trials have found AZT is effective not only in treating patients with AIDS, but also in those who are infected with the AIDS virus but aren't showing any symptoms of the disease. The wholesale price of a year's worth of AZT would drop to about $2,200. Its final cost to the patient would be higher, though, because of the retail markup. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina.
Researchers say that blood tests of prisoners across the country indicate that about 1 in 24 is infected with the AIDS virus. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 12.5 points in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Milo Miles follows world music for Fresh Air, and he says one of the surprises of world music is how many countries now produce their own variety of it. Deliberately international styles come not just from South America, Africa, and India, but places like Spain, Bulgaria, and now Algeria. Rye is the international export from Algeria, and Milo tells us how one of Rye's biggest stars is making his move for worldwide fame.
Oh, All over the globe, port cities are hot spots for new kinds of music. The reasons are the same whether the city in question is Oran, Algeria, or New Orleans, Louisiana. There are always streams of sailors, merchants, and tourists who bring strange music on cassettes and records and who want to hear their strange music played when they go out. There are lots of performers eager to entertain these party-hardy types. Eventually, the outsider's music blends in, and a new kind of song is born, one that looks outward beyond the seas. Algeria is an Islamic socialist country and protective of tradition. During the 30s and 40s, a frequent interjection in the urban music of the port city Oran was Yarai, which means roughly, "That's what I think." The impudent tone was all over the music, especially when it was about sex and sung by women. The most potent and provocative of the Rai pioneers was Cheka Rimiti. In this number, Gir El Baroud, you can hear Rimiti's raspy grit and also what old-fashioned Rai sounded like with traditional percussion accompanied by fiddles. Like most cultural developments that scandalize the uptight, Rai simply got more popular in Algeria. By the late 70s, pop Rai had taken over. This new wrinkle involved electric guitars, beats influenced by disco, and even more defiant themes. Male singers began calling themselves Chib and women Chiba, terms that mean young, but that connote something more like punk kid. The undisputed king of pop Rai is Chib Khalid. He's a style innovator, always interested in new electronics, and is notorious for pop star lifestyle excess. The big cars, the loose women, the whiskey swilling. Remember, all this is hardly old hat for an Algerian performer. Whether or not he corrupts the young, Chib Khalid should be the first worldwide star of Rai. No matter what the accompaniment, his voice hits hard. Here he is on Takadrek, with fairly conservative string section backing. By the way, this slightly dated style still has lots of fans in Algeria. Nice enough stuff. But the album I want to talk about is Khalid's new one with keyboardist and arranger Safi Boutella. It's called Kuche on the Capitol Intuition label. This is Khalid's first solo release in the U.S., and there's nothing conservative about Kuche. Its state-of-the-art studio clarity reveals fresh nuances and tensions in Khalid's vocals. Song after song, his tone is huge with power to spare. His delivery suggests a bit of a swashbuckler, even if you don't know any Arabic. It goes with his shark grin and bushy mustache. Chib Khalid is the Big Joe Turner of Rai. Kuche faces one predictable roadblock, however. The collection makes a conscious attempt at international breakout, which means it's heavily electronic and includes touches of everything from hip-hop to Afro-pop. You can hear Kuche means to be very uptown, and that bothers world music purists. These are the folks who insist performers have no right to mess with the traditional local elements in their pop music. Synthesizers and sin drums. Can't you hear all the sin in using them? The purists are a pain in the posterior. They can brand a bold record a mere sellout. It doesn't matter how unlikely or foreign an influence is incorporated into a song. Only intelligence and classy performance determine success. The song on Kuche called Cheba, for instance, barely sounds like Rai, but it's all Khalid's, and it still features that robust voice. This is not Julio Iglesias making concessions to world schlock here. It's worth noting that another new Cheeb Khalid album, called The Sacred Monsters of Rai, features no more than fiddle, percussion, and two voices. This proves that even if you sing with synthesizers, you aren't stuck with them forever.
Listening to The Sacred Monsters of Rai, Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes regularly about pop music for The Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. The Great Plains have been called the breadbasket of the world, the Dust Bowl, and now vanishing rural America. But to writer Ian Fraser, they're a time park, and I'll let him explain why in a moment. Ian Fraser is best known as a humorist for The New Yorker magazine, but in the fall of 1982, Fraser left New York for Montana. Over the next several years, he drove 25,000 miles back and forth across the Great Plains. His new book, Great Plains, is part history and part personal travelogue. His voyage began with his fantasy of what it would be like to live in Montana.
I'd have a ranch, I'd have horses, I'd have a big video, I'd have a big disc in the yard, I could get 1,000 TV channels, I'd have a library, you know, I'd fish for trout, I'd hunt, you know, people would come visit me, I mean, I'd go back and forth, you know, to the capitals of the world. I mean, I had envisioned a kind of a Hemingway-esque, or I don't know, just an idea of utopia, of just everything, you know. And plus, I'd just write real American great things, you know.
How close did you get to any of this?
Not close at all. I was desperately poor. I mean, we, you know, I ended up reading about it, was what it came down to, and not being able to live it too much.
Well, let me ask you to read a passage from your book about the Great Plains, and this is a passage about your motivation for exploring them.
Okay. Well, this is what I'm reading. I'm describing a time before I moved out. This is in New York. At parties, I told people, well, I'm going to be moving to Montana soon. And now, here I was in Montana. Suddenly, I no longer had any place to dream about. So I started to dream about the Great Plains. For fantasies, the Great Plains are in many respects the perfect place. They're so big you could never know all there is to know about them. Your fantasies could never wear them out. Even the plural in their name seems to make them extend farther into a distant romantic haze. Also, they are a place where I will probably never live. This is important because any place I move, I ruin. Look at the north side of Chicago. Look at Soho. I move in, the rents go up, coffee shops become French restaurants, useful stores close. Don't ask me how I do it. It's just a talent I have. 100 years ago, it was not unusual to hear of single men and women and young couples with families moving out to start farms on the Great Plains. Today you hear of people my age being urban pioneers in some neglected neighborhood, or moving to the suburbs, or moving to Northern California, or Washington, or Northwest Montana, like me. You never hear of us moving to the Great Plains.
In your book, you describe the Great Plains as feeling like an enormous time park. Would you describe that?
Well, where I live now in New York, things change in terms of time very quickly. You might not know the person who lived in the apartment that you live in. You might not know the person who was living there before you moved in. On the Great Plains, it's an arid region, like Egypt, other parts of the world that have preserved the past well. Things don't rot and fall apart very quickly there. So, and also, there's no real incentive for someone to tear down and build on the same spot. So, because there's so much land, so that if you do something, it doesn't work out. You build a house, you don't like it, you just leave it. But on a larger time scale, the Great Plains were probably the leading source of dinosaur finds, dinosaur bones, fossilized bones. Places where events in the Indian Wars took place often are completely unchanged. You can read a description of a battle that took place in 1874 and go back and the place is the same. And the geographic features are exactly as they were described. So when I call it a time park, I mean it's a place where you're a bit you're at loose in time, and you can be in the present. You can go to a hotel and watch, or a motel and watch MTV, and you're right now. You can go out and visit a museum, and you're in the Dust Bowl, say. You're talking to people. You can see in a museum photographs of the Dust Bowl, talk to people who are in the Dust Bowl. You can move much more freely in time.
Was it this sense of things remaining unchanged through time that sent you back to read so much history?
Well, yes. Also, if you try and, I mean, in our country now, history has been kind of debased to nostalgia. And so for people my age, you can get endless, endless doses of the songs that you listened to in high school, which to me has just totally lost its interest. You know, I don't want to hear Stand By Me again. I've heard it enough. I think it was that produced a larger feeling of claustrophobia, like can't we see a little bit more of time than just these years when we were in high school? And I just found an incredible appetite to find out about the history of America in the 19th century. It was something that I didn't know that much about, and here at the New York Public Library, in the main reading room, I found a place as much fun as the Great Plains to be in. A place where I could, I could get a book, I could get an original edition of the Journals of Lewis and Clark, you know, published 1815, and open the book, and these old yellow pages would fall apart, it was just a kind of a magical experience for me, and it was something I had visited these places, and it made these events that were described there make more sense to me.
In your collection of humor pieces called Dating Your Mom, you have a piece called Into the American Maw, and it's about your trip driving home from Boston to New York, and it's a parody of the kind of pieces about the savage nightmare journey into the heart of the American dream.
Right.
Did you want to make sure that your new book didn't become the type of thing that you were parodying in that piece?
Right. I think every savage nightmare journey I've ever read has seemed to be kind of too simple, you know. I mean, like, they just, you know, you get a bunch of drugs and alcohol and go careening off in a rented car somewhere. I think that's a childish, I mean, I think that that's something maybe you do when you're a kid. So you imagine a person on a savage nightmare journey, right, with a rented car and, you know, he's driving careening around the place. I just imagine him seen from the point of view of someone who lives in the town when he comes through. I mean, to me, Bonnie and Clyde are a savage nightmare journey in a way. And I just imagine, like, I'm sitting in the gas station and this guy comes in all juiced up on a savage nightmare journey, and I just know he isn't going to see me. You know, I know he isn't going to see the town.
So you think that there's a former travel writer who's blind to the average, to the normal?
And
is looking and projecting.
Yeah, and is trying to... it's as if you start out to write a piece already knowing what you're going to say before you interview mm-hmm. the person. You know, it's like when you're on a savage nightmare journey, you know, it can be kind of hard to, like, visit the Zane Grey Museum or something, you know? And someone says, did you know Zane Grey was a dentist? And you might be too savage nightmared out to pay attention to that interesting fact. Say, huh, Zane Grey was a dentist. And then you might miss something interesting like that.
Uh-huh. What got you to move back to New York?
Well, my family lives in the East. My whole family does. Also, I think there was just a plain old literary reason, which is that I had observed that my favorite books about the West, pretty much, a great many of them, were written by people who went out, spent some time there, came back, and wrote the books in the East. Or in Europe. I think that somehow it's easier for me to write about a place I really love when I'm not there. When I was just in Lincoln, Nebraska, and somebody asked me that question, why did I move back? And I said, well, because if I were here in this room, this was a church basement in Lincoln, Nebraska, I might not notice what a neat room it is. But there isn't a room like this in all of New York, and now when I get back to New York, I'll imagine this room.
Mm-hmm. Ian Fraser, I want to thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ian Fraser writes for The New Yorker. His book, Great Plains, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, are you tracking Hurricane Hugo?
We are, Terry, and what we're going to do tonight is talk to some people who have already seen Hurricane Hugo and what the storm is like. We also will be going to Chicago for a look at Operation Clean Sweep. It's a program where housing officials move into public housing projects in a kind of blitz to repair, restore, and secure their buildings and apartments in a very short period of time. And then we have some new research on what happens to the children of crack addicts, long-term effects of their mother's addiction observable in the children.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For the first time in any fall season, CBS has scheduled an evening of primetime devoted to nothing but sitcoms, and they're the only comedies on the network's entire schedule. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of the new additions to the lineup.
For CBS to build a successful comedy franchise on Monday night, it came into the season needing three good new shows. The returning veterans, Newhart Designing Women and the more recent Murphy Brown, are just fine, but CBS needed new blood. It'll get it, too, in Major Dad, and especially in a show called The Famous Teddy Z. The third new sitcom, though, is a dumb concoction called The People Next Door. And by moving in, The People Next Door lower the value of the Monday night neighborhood. First things first. Major Dad starts out the evening for CBS, and it's a wise choice. Gerard McRaney of Simon & Simon plays a career Marine who falls in love with a liberal reporter who's played by Shanna Reed. The fact that she has three daughters makes it a good family comedy for the leadoff spot, and the fact that McRaney and Reed play off each other so nicely makes it a painless comedy to watch.
Well, I've sailed into more than a few harbors in my time. Just strictly temporary layovers. I never even thought about dropping anchor. Till now.
Shiver me timbers. Are you trying to say you like me?
Well, that's a big affirmative.
Well, this is an eye-opener. Would have thought I'd get goosebumps when a man called me his favorite port.
The famous Teddy Z is funnier, and no wonder. It's written, produced, and directed by Hugh Wilson, who did Frank's Place and WKRP in Cincinnati. Teddy Z is a lot closer to WKRP, and it's almost as good. John Cryer plays Teddy Zakalakis, a temporary mailroom employee at a Hollywood talent agency. A veteran agent, played at full tilt by Alex Rocco, sends Teddy Z to pick up his client, the world's greatest actor, at the airport. By the time they get back, to the amazement of the head of the agency and especially to the client's longtime agent, the world's greatest actor wants Teddy Z to represent him.
So you're just driving along in the limo and he asked you to be his agent?
Well, actually, we were outside the car fighting. I just hit Mr. Kibo in the stomach and he had dropped to his knees.
You were fighting with Mr. Kibo?
No, not really. It was just that one punch.
So that's how you get clients. You pull them out of the car and you punch them in the stomach. Sure, I've been doing it all wrong. I take them to lunch and then, like an idiot, I don't even hit them. What the hell have I been thinking about?
Finally, there's The People Next Door. And the only perfect thing about this sitcom is that it's perfectly awful. Jeffrey Jones, who played the wide-eyed dad in Beetlejuice, is a cartoonist with a new wife and a strange imagination. He draws cartoons like The Far Side's Gary Larson. Only when this guy imagines things, they come to life. Unfortunately, given the guy's limited imagination and the fact that this show is on CBS instead of a more liberal cable network, the fantasies that spring to life are things like a talking moose head, a miniature airplane, and a grand piano with Steve Allen at the keyboard. Bored is the key here. The People Next Door is so bad I won't even make you listen to it. Use your imagination.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Dan Lachlan, Thad Kirk, and Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, cholesterol on trial. Investigative reporter Thomas Moore challenges medical claims that diet can lower your cholesterol or that lowering cholesterol will help you live longer. Also, Gary Taylor on how we've remade Shakespeare in our own image. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.